What up?
Yeah.
That's dope. You gave me a Dr. Dre, like, yeah. There it is. Now, what's going on, good people? Once again, this is Off the Record. My name is Adan Bean. You can hit me up on Twitter at ADANBEAN. To my left, your not direction, because you guys aren't publicly here with us.
One day they'll see us.
One day you'll see us. But to my left, the angriest Scott in the land, Dan Duncan. What up?
All the hands up, all the praise hands, all the thinking hands. Yes. We're here to make you type all the emojis into Twitter. You can hit me on Twitter at Dan Dunk, and probably gonna make you upset today. So that's what I'm here for.
That's what's up. Chuckling in the background, we have the one, the only, the greatest showman this side of the Mason Dixie, David Perdue. What up, sir?
First of all, I just want to say I love the word chuckle, because I often get a giggle, and it doesn't fit it appropriate. It's perfect for a grown man.
More manly.
Yeah, so I've been looking for that, because, like, I know it's a giggle, but
right.
But, like, can I get something with a little more? You know,
I feel like people would give you giggle, like, because you're like
jovial.
You're a larger gentleman. He just giggled, like, yeah. I'm just like the Pillsbury Doughboy.
Yeah,
but nah, you chuckling.
Chuckling, man. I like that. Yeah, David Perdue here. Y'all follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Do or Die. That's at DUEORDIE, man.
That's what's up, man. This is a skeleton crew this evening. It is just the three of us, three the hard way. But that's because we all working. We out here working.
Yeah,
but we making time for each and every single one of y'all. How you been, Dan? What you been up to?
Man, it's been good.
Working now.
Yeah, literally just hit a deadline. made y'all wait about 10 minutes on me. But life's been good, man. Weather is changing in Atlanta. It's no longer summer.
I love it.
We're going to start, like, barbecuing every weekend, and
hoodie season is here.
God, ooh, praise. So yeah, feeling good. And I'm just wondering what excavation in Egypt I need to get one of these things that you're wearing around your neck, because Adon is wearing the dopest Temple of Doom pendant I've ever seen.
Chose wisely. You chose poorly. I got a Senegalese connect, you know what I mean?
Okay,
that's what I got. A Burkina Faso homie, you know.
Okay,
keeps me in the know.
It's dope.
So yeah, man, I'm out in these streets shining.
Yeah.
So yeah man, man, David Perdue,
way more importantly these
days, fresh off the screen. Fresh off your television screen, ladies and gentlemen. He became animated and joined us like the Martin theme song. Like when Martin comes out of the screen and just starts dancing around the TV set, that's David Perdue. He has just left Comedy Central channel to become real life.
Man, I'm so glad the people that hit me up. I'm just happy y'all don't blink. You guys, eyes wide open. Y'all here paying attention. Yeah, man. Fresh off of the Comedy Central screen for a second.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. What was that like, man? I don't know I feel like I've done some big things, but I've not done big things that are nationally televised. You know what I'm saying?
I don't feel like I have either, honestly. No. What part was watching it was great to an extent. Then, like, I watched it with my there was like a viewing party with other people who were on it.
Okay.
I didn't go to that. I was like, I want to be around my family.
Yeah.
People, you know what I mean? And so I was, and it was interesting. Like, I didn't know how nervous I would be to be around my family.
Right.
Watching it. Like, it was around 11, I was just like, man, I can't, Poppy. I just want to be by myself. Like, I just wanted to wait. I wanted to go to sleep and wake up after. Then I was like, you got to take opportunity. I live tweeted, whatever. My little sister was like almost throwing up with, like, she just couldn't stand. Like, that whole moment. I don't know. It was the experience the day of was amazing. Mm-hmm. Watching it. It was, as an artist, it was a moment where I was like, this is good. This is good.
Okay.
In my head, because I was like, a lot of, and again, I'm very grateful for the opportunity. Shout out to Everybody involved, Kevin Hart. I mean, like, he's listening.
He listens.
He does listen. That's what I'm saying. That's why he listens. Joey Wells was the executive producer of One of Plastic Cup Boys and like Marabu Production. Like, all everybody, shout out for them for giving me a chance. But it was definitely, as an artist, it was one of those moments where you're just like, it breathes something in you.
Okay.
You know what I mean? You're just like, oh, okay. They, like, first of all, like, when they saw they spelled my name wrong, they put the P-U-R. And okay. I was just like, man, you didn't have to make that mistake. Like,
I filled out forms to be on this thing. Form.
Like, the worst part was, like, I had family hit me up, like, you don't know how to spell your name? And I was just like, man, I promise you I do.
You know what I mean? Like, did you ever think for a moment that I knew what I was doing?
What I was doing? But, no, as an artist, I think it might have been one of the, and I don't often say stuff like this, but like, it might have been one of the, like, the best moments that happened for me.
Nice.
Not as far as, like, the exposure, because, again, I might have got 3 Twitter followers from this, but it's hard to follow someone on Twitter when you didn't spell their name right on the TV. So,
hard.
But as an artist, like, it was just one of those moments, like, oh, you got work to do.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay, you got work. You so thought you was good.
So did it, okay, so that's what I want to know. Like, did it give you this thing where it made you feel like you had work to do because you saw others and were like, hey, I gotta step my game up? Or was it, man, I got work to do because I had a taste of this and I don't want to leave. Like, I want to come back. I don't want it to be an anomaly for me to be on your television screen.
Yeah.
You know what
I mean? All of that. Honestly, all of that. Here's my biggest, as soon as I saw how they had it, because I didn't get to see any of it before there.
Right.
I saw none of it. So as soon as I saw the opening intro and I understood, like, the style and the feel of it, I was like, oh, they took out everything. Like, I knew immediately. I was like, oh, okay, they're not gonna use my stuff that might be kind of like social comments. Like, they're not gonna use that,
right?
Mm-hmm. You know, and which when I went in, and maybe that's not necessarily the case. I don't know the editor and stuff like that, but I just had a feeling like, okay, they have an idea of what they wanted comedy in Atlanta to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I went into
for this show
specifically. Yeah. And I remember going into it being like, I'm not it, like, I love all those people. Keita killed it. Mm-hmm. Tamara Tori killed it. Like, but they all did fine, right? And I just remember, like, I remember thinking, like, which one of these things is not like the other?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And a sense of, like, just my, even where we all perform at. Like, I don't see them. Like, I know them, but I don't see them a lot. Mm-hmm. So where we perform at is different. And I remember going into this thinking, I have an opportunity, if done right, to be something different in this space.
Sure.
Right? And I was like, I could be very easily been like, oh, okay, I got this crowd. I have jokes for this type of space. But I was like, no, I want to stand out. I want to do jokes that are definitely going to be way different than anybody here. Challenge people in a different way, whatever.
Yeah.
And I felt like at the time of the live taping that I did really well.
Yeah.
You know, so I was like, oh, man, I got a chance. And then as soon as I saw it, I was just like, yeah, but it ain't what they wanted.
Yeah.
But it felt good because it was like, they saw enough in me to be like, well, we got to use them.
Right.
You know, we got to use them because it's good.
Sure.
Yeah,
but at the same time, it was like, you know, am I good enough to do something that's not necessarily on brand?
Yeah.
No. I'm not getting the 84. Kevin Hart made $84 million mm-hmm. last year. You think he gonna deviate from the game plan a little bit?
Right.
So I guess for me, a part of it was frustrating just because, and again, I don't know the editors. I don't know the thought processes like that. But there was a moment I was like, I felt like this is why I got motivated. I was like, there's no country for me.
Gotcha.
Right? And then I was like, oh, okay. Now I'm more motivated than ever to create my own country.
Yeah, dude.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, oh, okay. Because I knew that I get, I'll either get not black enough.
Okay.
Or, you know what I mean? Not black enough. Or what's the opposite? Or two, he's too.
What, militant? Too black?
Yeah. This guy's too. Yeah, if someone was there, he's. Why is he always talking about race or whatever,
obsessed
right?
With race,
so yeah. There's. Yeah, and it's like, it's not an obsession. It's just like, I have a perspective that I feel like not a lot of people want to tackle. So
well, I think you use. Why I love going to your shows is you use comedy as a tool to like reach people. Like, you realize, like, I'm here to make people laugh, but there's a secondary effect here that, like, if we accomplish it, if I do my job, like, it's gonna happen.
Yeah.
I'm gonna open people's eyes to a little bit of reality through comedy. And I think the best comedians do that. And I think the easy laugh is the easy laugh. Yeah. And I don't think you typically go for the easy laugh, which I really appreciate.
Yeah, I like to make people laugh at stuff they might feel about. You know what I mean? Like the feelings behind stuff. But I mean, you know, I had to come to this realization too. Like, I remember asking myself, like, if you could have one host of like the Emmys, right? And you get three comedians, Chappelle, Hart, Rock, who's hosting the Emmys? It's just anybody. Mm-hmm. Who's hosting it? Who would you have host the Emmy? You'd have Chris Rock or...
You're talking about personally? Just,
yeah, those three.
If I was between Chappelle, Chris Rock, and Kevin Hart?
Yeah.
Out of those three, I would want to hear Dave Chappelle.
You'd want to hear Dave Chappelle. But yes. who'd people probably
Kevin
pick?
Hart
they
is
pick that.
The most palatable for the larger audience, and, for the general audience.
And again, watching him like live, there's an appreciation for that dude. Mm-hmm. I don't think people realize mm-hmm. how hard... he works, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and I have nothing but the utmost respect. But it's like learning your lane as an artist.
Sure.
And so I was like, oh, okay. Like, I you start up in comedy, you start hosting. First, you do like guest spot, open mics, whatever. Then they let you host. Then you feature. Then you learn the headline. Right. Mm-hmm. Some people are amazing hosts, right? And that's what they'll do. They host. They get people to come in. They host. I learned how to be a good host coming up in comedy. Mm-hmm. There was a point in hosting. I'm like, I love this, and I have this skill. But like, in order for me to get in, there's a certain responsibility that comes with hosting, and I'm okay not having that skill anymore. Mm-hmm. Like, I want more time. I want to learn how to be a better feature because I'm gonna dig into more stuff that as a host you can't do because it messes up the atmosphere, right?
Right.
So when I asked all those people, I was like, okay. And I'm not saying I'm this person, mm-hmm. but I'm saying I don't want to be a great host mm-hmm. of shows. I want to have a host personality in the sense that you feel comfortable.
Yeah.
But I also, and I feel like that's kind of, my hero is Dave Chappelle. Mm-hmm. Like one of the things you'll hear, I remember hearing Chris Rock say, it's like each comedian is a child of another comedian. Mm-hmm. I'm one of Dave Chappelle's kids. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That style, that form, like everything he does, I watch it. That's my guy. So I wouldn't pick him to host anything because of who he is, but I'd watch him say whatever he wants to say for 4 hours.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so anyway, all that to say is during this process I definitely was like motivated to just be like, next time I'm on, they're gonna spell my name right.
Yeah.
Next time I'm on, like, I want to create a lane for people that feel like they don't have a country. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? That feel like they don't have a home. And so I'm like, all right, you got work to do, Dave.
Yeah.
Like, you thought you reached the mountaintop.
Mm-hmm.
Nah, bro, it's way bigger mountains, you know? And I was very, like, happy with that. I was like, you needed this.
There it is.
You needed this because people was patting you on the back. You was feeling good.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Night before, I was hanging out with Rosario Dawson. I was on top of the world.
I
was on top
that.
Of the world. And then all of a sudden, it was like, man, like, I told her, I was like, you gonna watch? She's like, yeah, I'm gonna watch. And I'm like, oh, thank, I hope she didn't watch. Like, I hope she goes, because she probably went, like, hopefully she didn't. I mean, man, hopefully she did.
Yeah.
But, like, I hope she doesn't think, like, that's all I got.
It's what I think it is interesting, though, because maybe she watched, maybe she didn't.
Maybe she didn't.
But I know that we watched Luke Cage, which she happened to be in.
Man.
She was there. And I know a lot of people, they didn't have to blink.
Listen, so, can I just say this?
Please.
It's bad. Everybody's been coming to me like, man, this is how you know the show wasn't like, it wasn't what people expected.
Yes.
This is how everybody greets me. Hey man, congratulations, I saw you on the thing. And I'll go, thanks. And everybody goes, what you think? That's how you know people have
interesting.
Yeah, that's how you know. So I said it to say, I don't feel bad, people, because this weekend Rosario Dawson told me, not only am I funny, but I smell good. So I dare you to try me.
Man.
I'm invincible. Man. I cannot be hurt.
Man, so you are Luke Cage is what you're talking
about. I'm Luke Cage. But don't tell APD that.
Okay.
Don't tell APD that.
Man, well, I definitely wanted to get into actually you know, Marvel's debut on Netflix of Luke Cage, which I think it debuted September 30th, so a little over a week ago, or going on a week from now, I guess.
It's Friday, right?
Was it just Friday?
Yeah, it was Friday. It came out.
It's so weird. Like, we're in that early October time that is weirdly, like, you'd be like, oh, only like 5 days ago. Like, yeah, it was September.
Yeah.
Like, just like, it feels just weird like to talk like that. But yeah. Anyway, so yeah, on September 30th, Marvel's Luke Cage came out to Netflix. Broke the internet this weekend, apparently.
Broke the internet.
broke Netflix for a little bit.
Yeah.
It was like at least 2 hours where it was down for most folks. They allegedly had experienced crazy amount of traffic. But yes, this series was created by Chael Hodari Coker, who has a long history in the business. But regardless, outside of that, it's just been interesting because this show kind of started, actually this character even kind of started for people who, in this, in essence, it was Marvel's response to people who had felt like they didn't have a country, like you were talking about, David, mm-hmm. right? They were like, oh man, we need to create this character. And it comes out of this time of 70s and what was going on in the culture and what were looked at as heroic figures during that time as well too. But yeah, so I think all three of us have seen some of the show.
I've seen the whole thing.
You've seen the whole thing.
Yeah.
Dan, you have seen about
three episodes.
Okay. I've seen going about 3.5 or whatever, but yeah, what are your thoughts? I guess I'll start with you first, David. Like, what were your initial thoughts of just seeing everything?
All right, to give it context, I've never read a Luke Cage comic book. I've never read any comic book. Mm-hmm. I've never even seen a comic book store. They're mm-hmm. not in my neighborhood, mm-hmm. so I don't know where those things are. But I'm a person who has watched pretty much, I think, all of the Marvel movies. Mm-hmm. I think the only Marvel thing that I haven't seen is probably like the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. thing,
okay,
or something like that on ABC. Okay. But I've watched all the Netflix. So like, I appreciate what Marvel does. Is like, we're gonna make a universe,
yeah,
and do that. So I was very excited about Luke Cage. And then what little I knew about it, I was like, all right, well, I know he's a bulletproof black man. Mm-hmm. That's big,
right?
And he's Harlem's hero. He's like, I knew he was like this reluctant, like, you know, hero that's just neighborhood hero, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Which I thought was very cool. So I know, like, me and Dan talked about it a little bit. The feel of the show, like, I love the feel of it, mm-hmm. right? And I remember watching it. I was watching my brother, and I remember thinking, like, oh, they're trying to do, like, one of my favorite movies is Black Dynamite. I don't mm-hmm. know how many people have ever seen it. Yeah. Michael J. White. It is sure. just a spoof on black exploitation movies.
Right.
In a very fun, like, it's one of the funniest movies I've ever seen. I remember watching the show and he couldn't breathe. Yeah. I remember falling on the ground, he couldn't breathe. Like, it was, man, there's so amazing. Many lines.
Yeah.
And I was like, it's like Black Dynamite, but without trying to be over the top funny. Mm-hmm. Like, even certain parts where, like, when he's walking, like, the musical choices that they choose mm-hmm. and, like, the angles, it's like, yo, if you've seen black, like, those old, like, I'm set, like, if you've seen those movies, mm-hmm. this is somewhat of an, they, this has to be like the story of how Luke Cage is kind of created. Mm-hmm. And so as someone who's watched the whole thing, I loved it. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I understand why I shut down the internet. I mean, once you get towards like some of the last episodes, you're just like, oh, mm-hmm. oh, I see what they're doing. Like, you know what I mean? Gotcha. It's a very timely piece.
Yeah.
And I was surprised Marvel went there.
Gotcha. Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like, I didn't expect Marvel to go. Some stuff I will be the first to admit that was like, this is too much. This is over the top. But again, if they're odes, it looked like they're odes to that type of film.
Yeah.
I'm like, it's not really over the top. It's exactly what needed to be done. Yeah. So I loved it.
Cool. And I'm gonna pivot to you in a second here, Dan. But I will say that one of the interesting things about the show in general has just kind of been the responses across the board about it. And I think that absolutely it speaks to, you know, it has that blaxploitation ode to it or whatever. But there's a lot of there's also some, you know, being that, you know, with blaxploitation in that time period, you know, the musical sounds, of course, were funk, were like kind of soul and disco in that time era, right? And so now you have this updated era of like hip hop being such a major global language, mm-hmm. And so with that, that is, of course, is a theme all throughout the series, yeah. for the most part, down to the fact that the actual episode titles are song titles of Gangstar. Like, mm. every single one of them.
I didn't even catch that.
Every single one of them is a Gangstar title.
Wow.
Step Into the Arena.
Oh, snap.
Moment of Truth. You
I
know,
didn't catch that.
To Get a Rep, or, you know, Don't Take a Part. Like, every single one of them is a Gangstar name of a song or whatever. Yeah. And so, but there's all of those types of things that are throughout it. And so one of the things that have kind of come out of it is often, you know, one of the responses has been from parts of the large and vast internet has been some Caucasian Americans feeling as though it's too black of a show. They are like, man, this is, you know, where's the diversity is one of the statements I've heard, right? Like they're like, man, there's no white people in this or very little white people. And why did Marvel do this? This is, some I'm sure have gone on to say that it's racist, but others are just like, man, this is just not diverse. This doesn't have whatever, blah, 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 blah.
You know what?
It's too black.
They man. Right. It was way too many black people in Harlem.
Say that you could say that
it was wait I was like I thought they took over Harlem. Where's all these black people in Harlem?
Yes, it's, you know, I do, you know, it's a very of course interesting thing when you find yourself not at the center of a story,
yeah,
how that makes you feel. And then you go, well, this is clearly now it's a diversity problem, right?
Yeah,
that there's not enough white people in this show.
I'm trying to think how many were there's only one, I think.
I'm thinking of one right now.
I think Shades is the only white.
Shades isn't white though. Shades isn't white. Shades is Puerto Rican, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
The only person that's white is the cop.
Scarf.
Scarf.
Oh, yeah,
Scarf
yeah,
is
yeah,
the
yeah,
only.
Yeah, yeah.
He's the only white person in the. Yeah.
But you know, aside from that, it's just like, man, this is we had. You know, I don't know. You had Jessica Jones. You had Daredevil season 1 and 2.
Yeah,
you had, like now.
You know how many times we film stuff in New York and with no black people?
You had an entire series called Girls,
which Friends.
Friends. Itself.
Friends didn't find a black person until like the last season in all of New York.
They had to go ahead and bring in Aisha Tyler.
Yeah,
Aisha Tyler and Gabrielle Union.
Yeah, they were
random,
all right,
like one-off date type things.
Right, but all of New York,
all of New York,
all the big metropolitan is New York.
All good. Regardless, that is one of the arguments. There's definitely an argument on the other side, which I'll get to into later. But just want to get initial thoughts from you, Dan. What were your thoughts about the show?
Yeah, so. You know, I've tried to describe this to multiple people, so I'll just kind of come out with it. I think that the first three episodes of Luke Cage is what happens when you take God's Not Dead and you combine it with Sesame Street, and then you throw in a genuinely good, needed plot line executed with terrible acting.
How do you really feel, Dan?
Yeah, I just wait for like Oscar the Grouch to like pop out next to Pop's haircut or barbershop. Just because I just, you know, nothing feels real. If everything in Luke Cage thus far feels very blocked out, very robotic, unauthentic. It feels like I'm watching a stage play. In the sense of a musical stage play where, like, when people break out in music, like, my wife loves musicals. Mm-hmm. For me, when people break out in music, it totally takes me out of, oh, this isn't real. No one breaks out in music, right? And, like, in this stage, in state of mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I struggle. And my craft is making really good, hopefully, documentaries.
Mm-hmm.
So, what I care most about in this world is authenticity.
Got you. What is like, so I think, you know, to push on that a little bit, just to kind of get it, have you flesh it out a little bit more, but like, what are you finding yourself, is it hard for you to connect to any characters? Is it the main character that is most problematic for you? Is it the setting itself that where there's some like dissonance for you as an audience to the actual reality that's portrayed on screen? Or is there any things that come to mind where you're like, man, okay, that sold me, but now I'm immediately taken out?
So I think for me, so what I want to make be very clear, because there are a lot of like trigger words around this because of Facebook and realities and Twitter spheres that people are going, what I'm not saying is this is not one, a good, like authentically black. That's not what I'm saying. I'm not addressing that, nor do I feel like I'm qualified to address that. What I am qualified to address is the authentically, I don't believe that Misty and her partner are actually partners. I don't feel like they have the dynamic that two partners that are police officers have. and I struggle to, in every scene that they're in together, I cannot believe the director was like, okay, we can move on now. I have the dynamic that I need here. Okay. And I think, and that just carries through in a lot of other ways with how they deliver their lines. Like it feels very scripted where they add in words that are, they're not needed. They're kind of superfluous. So it's like, uh-huh. as in common language and how it should be filmed is like them having a conversation. Hey, let's go over there. Mm-hmm. Instead, they add 3 or 4 or 5 extra words and they point like weirdly. They'll be sitting out in front of like the barbershop and like he'll point at a building and he's not even talking about the building. It just seems so kind of forced and it feels like the actors are being force fed by the director who's not able to get them in character and make them believable. Mm-hmm. I honestly don't believe anyone is truly their character. So
interesting. Yeah. Well, I mean, my take on it is, so I really just watched everything. I'm kind of 3.5 episodes in and kind of began and started it, which is two of the same things. I started it today. And so a lot of my thoughts are very fresh about it, I guess, and kind of a lot of it strings together. But similarly, so I had heard, you know, I had heard all the like, whatever, all the hoopla about the show. Like I had heard everybody like, yo, gotta check out Luke Cage. So I was like, okay, I'll eventually get around to this. But most of the people that I saw who talked about it, most people said, yeah, it starts pretty slow though. They kind of all said start slow, or that first ep, I don't really know about that one or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I did think about that. And I think you even brought this out in pre-production that there's like a different director for every episode.
Yeah. There's 10 directors, I think, and more producers than directors. Mm-hmm. I've been on a lot of film sets, a lot of, you know, short films, long form, feature length. I've never experienced something like that. So I couldn't possibly imagine how to do something that is changing on a weekly basis like that from a just creative standpoint.
Do you know who the directors were or like?
Yeah. I just pulled them up. Done? Yeah. So there's like 10 directors, more producers than directors. I can't imagine doing that, but yeah, I don't recognize, any of the directors. Most of them, once I kind of clicked on their names and IMDb'd them, are doing kind of B-rate movies. George Tillman Jr. is on the list though, who he did Soul Food, and also some other movies that are less reputable, like The Longest Ride.
What was that one?
It was a country.
I remember that.
It's what's his name? It's a Nicholas Sparks movie.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
But anyway, I think, yeah, to imagine trying to hand off, like, you see fall offs in movie series, like Harry Potter would be one that comes to mind immediately, that the director changed every 2 or 3 films. Mm-hmm. And you would see stark contrasts and really most movies when the new director came in took a step back in some way.
Yeah.
And they also got better in some ways, but you just, each one of these directors trying to create, the director, his responsibility is to make this character come alive.
Yeah.
His responsibility is to put these actors in the right state of mind with the right emotions and in the right moment and press record in that moment. That's his job. And to do that on a one-off episode, I can't imagine how difficult that is. So
yeah, it's so difficult for me to really talk about, because neither one of you have seen the whole thing. And so it's like, and I don't want to spoil it for a lot of people, but I just feel like if once you watch the whole thing, there's certain scenes and certain episodes that are so, like you said, timely, that are just like, oh man, okay. And kind of, I think it does get better as far, like I'm not a director, I'm not a film person like that, so I can't say what you'll necessarily enjoy the most, but I remember there were certain shots like this is beautifully shot.
Yeah.
And it's just a layman, like I'm like, okay. Mm-hmm. And like later on, like, you know what I mean, like later on episodes, because even when y'all were talking about like the first episode wasn't great, I remember thinking like, what was the first episode? Mm-hmm. Like that's how, you know what I mean, like that's how much it progressed, where it was just like, oh okay, like I'm not even, and I just think the story, like I don't know, it was incredibly timely. There were definitely some like over the top parts, but it's like it's also a superhero movie.
So yeah, that's the kind of part where I wanted to get to is that. So I'm kind of, I guess I was offering the slowness of the initial episode and the pacing and also just kind of overall immediate reactions to it. Not because they were my reactions, just because it's what was told to me before seeing it. My experience with the show has largely been like a net positive. Like, part of that though comes from, and I've said this before, like, I don't live in the Marvel world, right? I haven't watched Daredevil season one, season two, Jessica Jones, which I, you know, so I know that there are things and nuggets throughout this that I'm missing because I just haven't been, I've not kept up that way. I have an aversion, honestly, to the heavy tilt that creativity in film and TV has taken with regard to the superhero genre. Like, I think we do too much in it, honestly, at this point, and don't tell enough other stories as well. Not because I think that all these stories are bad and don't deserve to be told, just because I'm like, yo, we could greenlight something else. But that being said, so I felt like, to some of what you're saying, Dan, I felt like kind of some of the coldness with which some of the lines were delivered in certain ways, and the ways in which maybe they didn't speak emotively in a way that kind of whatever. I see that. I also, for me though, I always view it like, yo, this is, at the end of the day, it's a superhero movie, so there's a level of campiness that I just think is built into the genre, regardless of like what the movie, whether it's Iron Man, whether it's Thor, whatever it is, I always am like, yo, there's gonna be some things in here that are super corny. And you just gotta own it. Like, that's just part of what the genre provides. Right. And you kind of have to, and with that, you kind of have to, you know, realize that that's what it is. And along with that, with kind of the tentacles of blaxploitation that is part of this too,
it's even, or
that
more it comes corny. Of it,
that also is in there too, based upon the way in which blaxploitation,
like,
came
his
about.
Tagline is Sweet Christmas,
right?
Who said, you know what I mean, like, that's his, so you already, I mean, like, if you know that, you already know, like, oh, this is,
and what blaxploitation was, right, was this robust uber overreaction. Like, it was this desire to say that, hey, we, society is so terrible for black people that we are actually going to create these anti-folk heroes that are doing kind of above and beyond performances of blackness in ways they're just super exaggerated. So when you look at Sweetback Revenge, when you look at Coffee, when you look at all of these things, they're fighting the man, and they're fighting, you know, like, it's all of these things that, and that's what blaxploitation films kind of speak to. Now, what also came out of that is, much like anything that we create, maybe that might have an initial good purpose, it gets kind of perverted over time. And so then you have movies like The Mac and movies, like, you know, things that then just become, okay, now these aren't rebelling against the system anymore. Now we're just actually intra-racially denigrating our people in a way that is done on the same level of exaggeration, which is the argument that is made for what gangster rap has become since 96, 95 and on, you know what I mean? But along those lines, man, I just think that, I do think that that is like part of what is that disconnect there though. When I, like, every time something would happen and I'd be like, yeah, that was kind of corny. I was just like, yeah, but I think that like, the smart ass Tony Stark's statements that what's his name? Robert Downey Jr. made. I've always been like, yeah, that's not really that cool. Like, that's just kind of corny.
Yeah.
And it is what it is. But I do think, so I think that that's there. And then I will say this, some of the performances so far, because again, I'm only like 4 episodes in, like, Alfre Woodard is killing it to me.
Yeah.
As Black Mariah, like, I believe every single scene she's in. I've been a fan of, and I'm gonna mispronounce his name, but Mahasali Ali or whatever, the guy who plays Cottonmouth.
Yeah.
I've been a fan of him since he showed up on House of Cards, and then he's just continued to do great work even in really small roles. When he was even the small turn he had in Hunger Games, I was like, yo, this dude is like the truth. Like, I really mess with him, and I'm glad he has more of a shine or whatever. and you know, we could run down the list of different characters. I will say another like interesting fun fact is that like Chael Hadary Coker, he had kind of talked about how the swear jar that's in the first kind of one or two, three episodes or whatever, like that was an ode to Prince. His original idea, right? Well, for those that don't know, so Prince, since, you know, being a sex god for his early majority of his career, he became a very devout Jehovah's Witness. And like one of the things that he was dogged about was cursing. Like he did not like people cursing around him. I know personal stories of people at his house who were either put out of his house or quieted for cursing in his presence. And so it was a big no for him. And so the director Chael or the creator Chael Hadary Coker, what he was saying is that like that was an ode to Prince, that swear jar. And so what he wanted to do, actually, his initial plan was, once finishing it, was to show those first two episodes to Prince to get him in the final two episodes, actually. Like they, I don't know what role it was. Again, I've not even seen far enough to know what he possibly thought, but he had initially was like, I'm going to get Prince in this, wow, in this show. And so
I'd have lost my mind if Prince would have came out on Luke Cage.
If this was one of his last words, it's just been interesting. Man. But another thing I'll say too is that, like, you know, this can kind of bring out some other parts. So while there was the other side, there was one side of the argument that was talking about how like it was too black of a show, white people who felt like this, whatever, didn't speak to them in that way. There was another side, on the other side of the spectrum, who felt like, you know, black people who were like, yo, I'm not here for all these respectability politics that are being espoused in it, right? Like from the perspective of, there are people who had strong criticisms for Luke Cage because he's someone who, you know, has this aversion to the word nigga being used to him. His statements about like, you know, the tailored made suit and how that can make a man, and, you know, the arguments about, you know, just the way in which kind of these quote ancillary things can kind of protect you in a society that you know, views black people as hostile or whatever. So yeah, I take it from your face you hadn't heard this
I hadn't line heard of criticism. It there were moments where I thought that was going to be very big, like just the use of the word nigga, like I thought that was going to be like very big early on. Now I'm like trying to like back play,
right?
Trying to replay that. I mean, I don't know if how far, but like that was a very powerful scene. And like there are certain scenes you're just like, yo, this is almost like that you want somebody to pop up and like message, like sure. You know what I mean? Like,
and I think that's part of it too, is that like there's things, man. I mean, like there's a part in one of the episodes where like, and this is not giving anything away, but like, They go into a discussion about the Moynihan report that the CIA created, like, and you're just like, yo,
they don't even know.
Like, but, you know, and so I think on some level, I've heard people similar in your field, Dan, who are work in the film industry, and some of their issues may have been at times like, man, like, there's got to be a better way to provide exposition than doing it in such a straightforward manner that like
it feels very force-fed.
Yeah, like, man, this doesn't have to be so heavy-handedly displayed or whatever,
which is the connection to the Christian movie.
Yeah, that was the side that you were,
it's
making,
it's just a very heavy-handed message
first and then
let's tell
story.
You yeah let's tell you what we want you to know and then how we want you to feel about it.
I understand, gotcha.
Yeah, I think so. Interesting, like, I will say this, there are definitely scenes in there that do that. But again, if you know how like some of those movies are, that's what they did. You know what I mean? Like, that's so we talked about it earlier. It's a genre, it's a style of film. Like we talked about with like people who like kung fu movies, right? And you're like, I can't get into kung fu movies, I don't get it, right? But then those people, it's like they understand that that's what the directors are giving them. They're giving them this thing.
They're willing to deal with bad acting,
or just the over top message. But if you watch the whole thing, there are certain messages that are like, they just threw that in there on the slide. And if you caught that,
Yeah, sure.
You know what I mean? So I'm just watching, like, because I appreciate your criticism of it, because I think that's very real. But at the same time, I'm like, oh, you're like, it's kind of the kung fu movie thing. But I think if you like, I want you to, I almost want to watch it with you.
Yeah, yeah, and we will.
Yeah, because there's like certain parts. It's like, yes, you're right. But however, did you catch this? And so they're not completely blind to that.
Yeah, and you have to understand too. It's like I have a tick watching it because the editing. Overall, everything else is the worst part of the whole thing.
I hate editing.
Whoever the editor mm-hmm. team is,
yeah.
We have a very different definition of how to pace something.
Okay.
And so their pacing, most people have seen interviews, right? And then, like, so the interviewer will ask a question, and then it'll cut to the other angle, the person answering the question, and back and forth, back and forth. It's this ping pong effect that you get.
Mm-hmm.
This is cut with a ping pong effect. Line, cut, deliver line, cut, deliver line, cut, deliver line, cut. It feels very piecemeal together.
Okay.
Does that make sense how I'm describing that?
Yeah, I understand.
And so it feels, and so, you know, art is very easily explained. Anyone can create, like right now, I hate this show, but I could sit here if I made it. It's like, well, it's like a comic book because you read one frame and then you go to the next frame and then you see the next thing. And so anyone can rationalize these things. Anyone can get up here and make some shit up and say that it's good. Me personally, I think that it feels super choppy and it's exhausting for me. And I would argue that it's exhausting for other people subconsciously and they just don't know why and they can't articulate why because of the way they cut it. And so I read a quote that they purposely tried to make this like a binging TV show. Like they didn't, this wasn't meant to be like watched and then come back to it a week later. Like they made it so that you would want to click next. And I actually feel like in a lot of ways they didn't accomplish that. If that's the goal, they missed the mark on that. There's other shows that I'm like, I want to click there. Atlanta. I get upset every time I can't watch another episode of Atlanta or Stranger Things are these other ones that I binge on, and I'm actually not a binger, so maybe that's the problem. But
and I think also though, similarly, when we first talked about Atlanta, you weren't feeling the first episode.
It's true.
So you were very.
I went in with very very high expectations though for that first episode. So in no way would I take away from the thing. I hold Childish in such high regards with his artism. So
I think I think when I watched the show, I saw parts where I was like, oh, this is where a commercial could go. Honestly, like I felt like, oh, if they just wanted to put this on like a primetime network, like commercial could go there, and then you like come back, and this could be the beginning of the next thing or whatever. I do think there was a few scenes though, and some of this might just depend with different director. I don't know if the editor changed. With each, I'm not sure.
There's three editors listed in the.
But like, as it's pretty fresh in my mind, like there's two scenes in particular that like stick out in my brain, and both of them involve the character, of course, Cottonmouth or whatever. But it's interesting because he like there's the one, of course, where not giving anything away, but where there's the. Where he's talking about the Biggie image behind him or whatever, and the different movements he's making to adjust the crown, essentially, you know, with regard to the backdrop on him.
Yeah.
That, and then I think even a later episode, it might be in the third episode, I think. But David, you'll probably remember, but when he and, Shades, is that the guy's name? When they're having a conversation about what to do in the office about Luke Cage, and there's you know, not giving anything away, but there is a something that is like a device of some sort that is like, oh, they're like, oh, we could use this on him. And when asked for the price, he writes it on a piece of paper and then gives it to him.
Yeah.
What I've always observed, right, is that they kept the shot wide for that, right? Mm-hmm. And like when he takes the paper, you never see what's on the paper. They never they never zoom in to see his response to it. They keep it wide. And one of the things that, you know, I've couple other friends who worked in film, and they always talk about how you can tell the like someone's more comfortable with regard to shooting when they're willing to keep something live, when they're willing to keep it far and wide or whatever. There's just a different, you know, one of the early mistakes that directors will make, or kind of like a rookie thing, is like, oh, let's get close, let's make sure that we're seeing all this or whatever. It's like, no, but if you can just let something live kind of with some space there, you're kind of showing some control and some respect for the audience to say, hey, this is how someone actually just watching this scene would see it. Like, they wouldn't run up and see the face on this person and then turn and look at the face on this person. They would see the whole thing play out that way. And I thought that that was a really, like, I was like, oh, man, that's kind of dope.
And, I'm sure that each director sat in and watched their edit, their episode come together. And so I'm sure that director for that episode said, hey, we're not gonna hop it, because I'm sure they had the coverage, I'm sure that it was there, and it was probably like,
so your thought is that there probably were shots that did show it, and they were like, no, we don't need,
we're
that.
Good, this lives perfectly how it does right here. Let's that's as much control, that's a lot of control for the director to frame that up and make that have enough happening in the frame that it keeps your attention. And then it takes a lot, as much control for the editor to say, okay, we can hold on this.
Gotcha.
And so, yeah, I mean, again, I'm sure it's going to change.
Are you going to finish watching it? I guess that's more.
No, I'm going to, for the very fact of like the industry I'm in and conversations that I'm sure we're going to be having here at Off the Record, I'll finish it for sure. But
I wish y'all seen it already. Like, it's so much, I'm like, but I don't want to.
Isn't that interesting, though? Like, this came out Friday.
Right.
And people are like, can you catch up? Like, I'm like, what?
Yeah.
It's Wednesday. It's not even Thursday yet.
Right. Yeah. What's interesting, like, so when it came out Friday, I was like working at home, and I was like, man, you know what? I just don't feel like watching it now. I watched all of Narcos season 2 or whatever, which of course is another Netflix original series. And I watched that in like 2 days, and I'm like, but like, I still feel like I'm behind because I've not watched Luke Cage, which came with, like you said, which came out Friday.
Man,
and so I can't jump into all these conversations, but I'm good with that. Like, I think everyone should watch at their own pace.
It's just so much dope stuff toward the end. I'm just like, oh man, y'all don't even know.
We'll be all right.
I hate just being the guy that hates. So let me love on something from Netflix that if you do want something else, they just came out with a new documentary called White Hats. Okay. And it's about the civil rescue force in Syria, throughout Syria, that it goes in after bombing, Russia or whoever else is bombing the United States, and rescues the people who are buried in the rubble. Wow. And they're the first to show up. Amazing piece.
Yeah.
Hard to watch at times, but super, super good. The video that went just viral on Facebook with the baby.
Yeah.
That person is one of the people who's documented in White Hats.
Gotcha. Man, well, that is that, man. I think what's interesting is, amidst everything, and I was talking to a friend about it, like, there was an amazing amount of, like, here, and I'll say this as we transition to the next topic, but like, I feel like what's dope, like, now that we're seeing is that, like, particularly with representation in regards to like Black people on television and screen and whatever, is that like, there's varied options, which means no show has to be everything for everybody, right? And so what's dope is that, like, what was happening before and often is that, like, one show would be weighted, or one movie would be weighted with portraying, you know, everything for all. I mean, and we constantly make this refrain about, oh, well, Black people are not a monolith, but then at the same time, Black people will come to things with the expectation as though, hey, this should speak for me because I'm Black.
Yeah,
and this is Black, so this should speak for me.
It's due to the thirst.
Due to that, right, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, the cosign of that, or the other side of that, of course, is that white America would often view, like, well, we gave you this one, so
yeah,
you should be okay. And it's like, well, no, this is not everything. But if you look at, you know, whether it's everything that, you know, Shondaland has given you to, you know, with Scandal and whatever, what have you. But if you have, you know, Queen Sugar with Ava DuVernay.
I still haven't seen that.
beautifully.
All right. Beautifully. I've heard everything good about it. I got
Queen
check
Sugar,
that out.
Insecure with Issa Rae.
That comes out this Friday, right?
It's actually up right now.
Is
you
it?
Can, yeah, like, or HBO Now, you can view it actually. Ooh. I already saw the pilot for it. So, yeah.
I'll be watching it.
Insecure, Blackish, Atlanta, right? We already talked about The Rodney Carmichael Show, Power, Empire, Survivor's Remorse, Greenleaf. Like, there's so many different shows, whether it's sitcom or drama or whatever, and you can be like, oh, well, Empire's over the top. Well, it's a melodrama, like,
right?
That's just what that's gonna be. Watch Power if you don't, you know, like, it's just varied options there, and that's what I think is most important.
That is, I didn't even realize you just named a bunch. I didn't realize we had that much people.
Bruh, I like, left stuff off too. Yeah, bruh.
The one, the show that you told me about, that with the start of hip hop that's on Netflix now.
Oh, the, yeah, Get the Down. Get Down, right? And particularly the ones I named had to do with black creators and showrunners.
Cool, cool.
But the Get Down certainly has a lot of hands in it. And you know what? Let me not take that out, because Nelson George, who is an amazing, you know, author and writer, whatever, like, he was behind the Get Down. It was just kind of directed by Baz Luhrmann or whatever Shakespeare dude in the Great Gatsby updated version. But there's so many different shows that you could, that we just have the options to watch at this point. The Breaks on VH1, which will be coming back soon. Mm-hmm. So all of that is to say, there's varied options. One of those options has been talked about for the better part of a year now, and that is a movie coming out this Friday. That's what we're talking about. We don't know if it's an option. That's what we're about to find out. Ladies and gentlemen, we are talking about I was gonna make a joke, but then it just felt terrible to make the joke, so I'm gonna just hold off and not
take it from a professional.
Let me just go straight forward. So yes, we're talking about The Birth of a Nation, which is the film having to do with the Nat Turner uprising and rebellion. Bloody and violent rebellion of Nat Turner in 1831. And now in 2016, we are getting a film that originally kind of got on some people's radars, I'd say about a year ago. But then it continued to grow, because once it debuted, the film festival, was it Sundance? It was Sundance.
Broke records.
It was like 17. They bought it for like 17 million.
17 million. The highest that had ever been purchased for an independent film. And of course, this whole film was independently financed, independently shot over the past, I think 8 years was the amount of time that it took to do this.
Jeez.
With all of that, you know, Fox Searchlight? Is that who bought it?
Of course. That team, they buy all the good movies, bro.
For real?
Oh, dude, if you see Fox Searchlight on something, it's like,
give me some names, go. Just so I can...
I'll pull up their last 10.
Okay. As you do that, so Fox Searchlight definitely was like, you know what? We are going to put... We have the money to do this, right?
And then, 17 million? Yeah.
And then two, we're going to put a big bet on it. Like, we believe in this. We are going to double down on this and see what we can do with this right here. And a lot of times, right, what's interesting is that they were not the only suitors, right? Like, like once this film showed to standing ovation at the festival, and it was almost, as all reports account, it was almost like off to the races immediately after, or whatever. Like, they kind of were calling their shot, which is how that number got to 17 million. But all that is to say that as time has progressed, it has eventually been muddied and marred a bit by the controversy of the creator, the writer, the main actor, the portrayer of Nat Turner in the film.
Did he direct it?
He directed it as well, too. Yeah, yes.
He did a lot.
Yeah. We are talking about Nate Parker, who is a somewhat known actor in the realm of, like, if you've been paying attention over the last 5-7 years, I'd say, you could kind of recognize, say, oh, that was this, you know, guy from The Great Debaters, or you might be like, oh, this dude played in Beyond the Lights or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But this,
I love that movie. Let me be more clear. I love Google.
Oh, I'm with you. I understand.
Oh man,
honestly though, I'll back you up. That movie wasn't bad.
It wasn't bad. Though.
It wasn't bad. It was a lot better than I thought it was gonna be going into it. And I think that was done by Gina by the Wood Prince or whatever who did Love and Basketball and
I can see
some
that.
Other stuff. But
I can see that.
Regardless, Nate Parker though has a he had a past, of course, in the history. That has kind of popped back up with regard to him being at the forefront of this film and this endeavor. And it has to do with some things that occurred or an incident that occurred while he was in college. You know, Parker now is 36 years old, but back to when he was in college at Penn State, he was an athlete, a wrestler, I believe, on at Penn State. Basically, he was charged with rape of an 18-year-old girl,
sophomore,
and basically he was charged with rape. Him and someone who is now also a co-writer on The Birth of a Nation, mm-hmm. his roommate, mm-hmm. Fellow wrestling teammate, Jean, I'm not sure, Celestine. Two black men, want to be very clear, and Parker was eventually acquitted of rape. However, Celestine was convicted of sexual assault and faced 6 to 12 months in jail. He later appealed when the Superior Court increased the sentence to 2 to 4 years, but a retrial never happened because the accuser actually just did not want to testify, did not want to go through that whole process again. One of the reasons that Parker was actually acquitted is that it was harder to prove that it was not consensual between her and him, based around a few factors, but most largely or most glaring is the fact that they had a sexual encounter prior to that evening. That woman, she gave him oral sex. But what ended up happening the night in question, or what was alleged the night in question, is that she went over to their place or whatever. They were she alleges that they were fooling around. They had, you know, and that she drank something, but then just became unconscious, and that she was then raped. And in her moment, like, she says that there was like moments of clarity or moments where she like could kind of come to and identify that Parker was on top of her and entering her. And then there was another moment that she blacked out again. There was another moment she could come to. And Jean was also in the room and like basically was also assaulting her sexually. And with all of that, she just did not remember anything else, and so that's where the charge came from. Now there's other elements of it too, right, which also include the fact that she there's like a little transcript floating around of kind of conversations that happened after the night between Parker and the victim or whatever, in that like she he like, in which Parker has kind of you know, kind of leaned on her to say like, hey, you weren't raped, and like really did not, you know, in some very strong ways was trying to say that, you know, that this did not occur, and that she does not I think a quote exactly is that for you to say that you were just passing out and this and that is totally, that's wrong. I'm saying that you were totally conscious. You may not remember. You may say that you don't remember now, and I can understand you saying that, maybe, but you were completely conscious. You know, there's also a part where the woman herself, like she had called him trying to like get him to name a third man because she said she couldn't remember everyone who was involved in the sex that night. And so because there was more than just Nate Parker and his roommate who were there that night. And so there's one person, Tamerlane Congas, who was essentially waved in to the room, which is this other part of it. I'm telling this story so badly, but with the other part of it is that Nate Parker was having sex with her and then essentially invited his friends in to run a train on that girl or whatever. And to Congress or whatever, he didn't go through with it. However, the roommate allegedly did. And so the conversation has to do with regard to like, was she conscious? She wasn't, all this, that, and third. Unfortunately, what happened, I think in 2012, I think is when she, now at this point, 30 years old, she committed suicide. And so she's actually no longer here to tell her side of the story. But it was largely said that she was kind of tormented over the years since that experience. And I think it might be her sister who has come out in a article who has said that like it kind of tormented her to see his continued success, Nate Parker's continued success, while she's kind of left to deal with whatever. Let me also say they sued the university and received some money for that. Once they didn't pursue any more criminal charges against Nate Parker and the person. So there's all of this that's going on. What's most recently come out is that you have this film and there is, you know, it's supposed to be based on a true story, but there is an ahistorical rape scene that is in the movie that was written, of course, by Nate Parker and by the co-writer and past co-defendant, which there's this rape scene that occurs that is set to be this kind of
the thing that the catalyst.
This impetus for a lot of the action that comes out of it. And so that is seen as well as that is seen as disrespectful as well by some people. And so there's been this larger conversation around rape culture, around this movie, around our responsibility as people, you know, just where do we land on it? Everything. Nate Parker has gone on to do a lot of interviews. I think they've been pretty not good at best to say it's with regards to him.
Moments of okeness.
Moments of okayness.
He's like, man.
Then he's like, ooh, who is running PR for you? But regardless,
so what's an example of something that he would, that, because I haven't seen a single one of his interviews. So what, when someone's listening to this, like, what is he doing that you're like shaking your head at?
First, just the idea of trying to address it. Like, I can't give you sound. I can't give you like quotes or whatever. Yeah. But like, a lot of people would definitely like, I have my lawyers talk about that or whatever. Like,
okay, he's addressing the rape.
He's actually like, there's moments of addressing it.
I'll step in here before you continue to use that. Like, so yes, there's that piece of it. But I think even in the manner that he has chosen to address it, when it was initially brought up, when it was initially brought up, the argument or his perspective, his initial reaction was more of, I'm the victim here.
Yeah.
I was done. Like he centered himself in this story, which you can make an argument either way. I won't make that argument the other way, but I would say that part of the issue is that making yourself the victim, when there is someone who's no longer here.
Yeah.
And you are now, you know, out there flourishing. Like, let's say, you know, I won't relitigate that piece, but yeah. So there's that piece of it. There's the part of it where, he, you know, they've asked him, of course, to apologize a few times. He's not apologizing. He refused to apologize. I think his position, his stance is more of like, I didn't do anything wrong, so I'm not going to apologize. But I also think the way in which he chose to engage it, which I think is some of what you're talking about, David, is that some of the, like, he'll be asked questions directly that he will then pivot and just be like, well, I mean, why are we talking about this? Like, why? And he'll say oftentimes like, well, you know, I kind of already discussed this. Well, he actually kind of didn't discuss. He kept kind of kicking the ball each time, saying there'll be time to talk about this. Like, someone actually brought it up at Sundance and he said then, like, you know, this is not the time to talk about this or whatever. Like, there'll be more than enough time to talk about it. And essentially the time that he most directly addressed it was most recently on 60 Minutes with Anderson Cooper. And even then, he was just very much like, hey, like, as a let me also say, for I believe he's a Christian now. He professes as a believer. And so he essentially, he has said, I think, at times that, like, as a Christian man, he never says I apologize, but he's like, I should not. There's things that I should not have been in that position, I think, is a direct quote. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's just a very, there tends to be a lack of empathy in some interviews, more so in others, where, like, it's like, I don't feel like,
you don't feel like he gets it.
Yeah, that's really what it is. You don't feel like he gets it. You don't feel like
the severity of what's going on.
And this could all be terribly wrong on the outside looking at this, right? Where you're looking at it and you're just kind of like, man, you know, maybe this is someone who's dealt with this for 17 years now at this point, and they're just like, whatever, I'm tired of having to talk about this. Well, the issue is that you might have talked about all of this privately, but now you're publicly in front of the world.
Yeah.
And so it's being talked about amongst us for the first time in a way, you know? But you know, again, it's a very interesting dynamic. I'm sorry, David, you were saying.
I was just going to say this. A couple things. One, there's an initial reaction that you got from people, because people wanted to, first you had the people who wanted to boycott. And I understand that, and they have their right to boycott the movie. If that's what you want to do, do that. Then there's the people who say, there's the conspiracy theorists who say,
oh, gosh.
Yeah, who
miss
say,
me with this.
Who's like, yeah, who are like, yo, we got to finally get a movie portraying this, and then it's, I'm pretty sure, it's just like Cosby all over again.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's, like,
man,
that's
the white man,
yeah,
you know, don't want to see this film come across.
Right. And so,
that's why you,
I remember just kind of,
dollars,
like, I've been very torn, because it's a story that I want to see told, mm-hmm, or, you know, have that story out there, but at the same time, like, am I, like, supporting this or whatever, right? Like, that was a real conflict for me. And then I remember Gabrielle Union is in this movie, and every time she speaks, I fall more in love with her. Like, she just she just makes the most sense all the time. Mm. And the main reason I wanted to see during all this controversy was, like, she's in, not only is she in the movie, she is a rape survivor.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And I was just like, man, all right. Well, I remember when I knew that, I was like, well, I'm taking cues from Gabby. I'm taking cues. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I just saw this quote that she had. She said, I took the film to talk about sexual violence. I took the film to talk about sexual violence as it's used historically as a weapon of mass destruction that destroys the psyche and soul of our community. And it just seems as backwards to distance myself from a film that creates and gives me the platform to talk about sexual violence. Then she also said, it says, Union, who's been vocal about her own rape, admitted she had countless conversations about sexual assault with Parker, who plays Nat Turner in a film. And then her, this is my favorite quote. She says, I'm not going to leave that man the same way I found him. I have to educate him. He's raising 5 girls. I have to educate him. Now, there's no, rape is inexcusable, right? It is very much so inexcusable. That being said, and maybe this is just the Christian in me that comes out every so often. I always look for, in these moments where people are, they've either done something that's unforgivable, it's like, how do we restore people? Mm-hmm. And so I feel like everyone is this shining light. Because if anybody could fire off on how he's responded to everything, it's her, mm-hmm, being in this movie. But her kind of approach is like, we're going to turn this into something good. She's like, I'm not going to leave this man the same way I found him. Mm-hmm. I think that's very powerful. Should it give everybody a license to say, oh, Gabby said it's cool, we should go watch it? No, stand by your convictions. If you feel like you don't need to be watching this movie, you can't support it, by all means. Me, just, I wasn't necessarily looking for a reason to justify myself watching it, mm-hmm, but something about her kind of stands, somebody's in his ear, it sounds like somebody's in there constantly, and maybe, like, trying to keep him in check who's close to him. And I think, I think that's important.
Yeah, I think so. I would say also that, you know, while he, I think that Gabrielle Union's, when she came out as strident as she did, you know, and very vocal in a way that I think was like, hey, like, I'm a survivor and I'm in this film and this is like my position and the way I want to go about. Like, I think that that honestly renewed a lot of people with regard to like, okay, I don't feel as, you know, icky about going forward with it or whatever, which is its own, you know, another way in which you're like, man, another black women just holding down black men.
Man,
it just doesn't stop, right? Yeah. But in that being said,
we're gonna do right by y'all one day.
From your lips to God's ears.
Yeah.
But I think also though, it just, I feel like every time he goes on an interview, it reopens it up for a lot of people because people might feel like, okay, Gabrielle Union did a lot of work to renew me back. And then when I see him out there talking, I feel like it's essentially that same eye test, right? Where people feel like, I just don't feel like it. I don't feel like you got it, you know? And so
what can he say for us? What could he say?
And so that's the kind of the part where some people get to is they're like, well, what are we expecting of this person to say? Right. Cause from his perspective, right. Well, let's back up before we get there. There's these other two parts, right? There's the whole conspiracy theory, right? That like, for whatever reason, this was held out and that all of a sudden now this is being brought up out of nowhere. They didn't bring it up allegedly around Beyond the Lights. They didn't bring it up allegedly around The Great Debaters. No film. He's the most visible that he's ever been. So whatever's in your past, that's why this is showing up. There's no Illuminati conspiracy to stop this from happening. It's like, yo, this is just what it is. To your part though about like what do we expect of him to say, right?
Him or even I think it is interesting. I think to kind of make this more general is like the idea of like, because I think we talked about it in pre production or whatever, just like artists and then that like finding a way and how do you support them or how do you don't support them and like what their responsibility is, so on and so forth. Like, so, you know, obviously as a comedian, Cosby's one of those things. Like, can I watch the Cosby Show? And I always tell people, Cliff Huxtable didn't do anything.
No, he didn't.
Bill Cosby did all that stuff. Yeah. Cliff Huxtable did nothing wrong. You know, and not to say that like to make light of what he did.
No.
But I will say this, there is a moment where you do, I'm not a conspiracy brother by any means. I'm awoke, you know what I mean? I'm paying attention. But there was something very interesting to me when I remember watching the dad from Seventh Heaven admitted to molesting a young girl, right?
Yeah.
And yet Seventh Heaven is still on the Christian network all the time. Right. They didn't think about pulling that at all.
Yeah.
And that, I'm again not conspiracy, but there was a moment I was like, "Huh, why would they not?"
Yeah, I mean,
but
I think
it's not like they're pulling this movie from the movie theaters.
No, deciding... but the Cosby Show has been pulled.
Right,
that's what I'm saying.
I think the two. I saw that too, and my perspective more was, well, I think that quote whatever of Christian Network is still showing the Seventh Heaventh or whatever. Like, my mom loved that show. Like, my mom was about that show.
Yeah, I watched that show growing up.
But. I always view it like, man, there's just such a vast disparity between the impact that Seventh Heaven had and the Cosby Show had. And so I can't even tell you that lead actor's name. I can see him, but I can't tell you his name offhand or whatever. Whereas Bill Cosby was this transcendental figure, not just for Black America, but for America as a whole. So I think that the disparity often comes with how high a height something is that brings it down or whatever.
Okay.
I would say, though, with regard to that, just in general, like when you're talking about from a wide lens perspective, is there something that can be done that makes someone step down, like where you can't appreciate their art? I can still watch The Cosby Show. I agree with you completely. Mm-hmm. I still laugh at all of those things. Where there is a difference is when someone who the art that they're presenting is based upon largely the transgression or issue or sin that is a part of what they're presenting. So for me, I can't rock to R. Kelly. Like like I recognize the skill and talent like vocally.
Yeah.
But I'm like, man, when I hear you singing, I know you wrote Age Ain't Nothing But a Number.
Yeah.
Like, I know that.
Yeah, we know this.
I can't rock to that the same way because I know what is your that proclivity. Meant, like, I know what that is for you. So it's a bit harder for me, you know, in that way with, you know, I'm not a big Woody Allen fan, period, honestly, as like in, with regards to movies. So there's just not, I don't have that same, like, yo, this dude seemed like a scumbag and like, I could care less about most of his movies as a result, you know, but it's not, there's not like a result thing. It's like, I just don't necessarily rock with his movies beforehand.
Michael Jackson.
Yeah, that's an interesting one.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean,
what's weird is that perpetual childhood has largely informed a lot of his works,
mm-hmm.
but that doesn't stop me from, like, and while he might have, you know what I'm saying, some things that, like, man, it's kind of off.
Yeah.
He's saying we can only listen
to Jackson 5, Michael Jackson.
I ain't saying that at all. I rock to all of it. That's what I'm saying.
I get you.
But, you know, Dan, what are your thoughts in general about just the film? And we've moved the conversation forward to just art as a whole. But what do you think?
No, I mean, going back to just the film, I think it's going to be a very important film. I mean, everything I've seen and heard of the film, I mean, it lit Sundance on fire. So I cannot wait to see it. Mm-hmm. I think the message will be important. And I think, man, the sum is greater than the part. So I think people need to see the film. Just from a historical standpoint, it is a critical piece in our country's history that we have largely ignored. So I think that's really good. As far as Nate Parker goes, I think, you know, it's tough. The unrepent, like, there's grace, right?
Yeah.
The unrepentance, though, and at least the acknowledgement that that someone, your actions led to someone's life forever being changed and probably played a piece and ultimately an ending. To not mourn that in a way that to say at least, like, I know that there was wrong here. And I can't put a finger on, like, me specifically, because I can genuinely look you in the eye and say I didn't feel like I was wrong in the moment, even if that's it was his deal.
Yeah.
But seeing the repercussions of what I thought was a legitimate action that was mutually desired,
mm-hmm.
seeing the repercussions proves to me that there has to be some level of regret on her end.
Mm-hmm.
And whether that be because she was with me or because she didn't want to be with me or because she was saying no in the moment, that obviously is for other people to debate in other times or right. whatever in courtrooms. But just to not be broken over that in front of this interview and just to say, like, my actions led to the death of another person.
In fairness, and I completely agree, and I think you articulated it well. I want to be fair to his position in that apparently he did not know she died until, like, this year, until, like, news got to him that she had passed. So he had posted on Facebook something in which he said, I myself just learned that the young woman ended her own life several years ago, and I'm filled with profound sorrow. I can't tell you how hard it is to hear this news. I can't help but think all the implications this has for her family. I cannot, nor do I want to, ignore the pain she endured during and following our trial. While I might maintain my innocence that the encounter was unambiguously consensual, there are things more important than the law. There is morality. No one who calls himself a man of faith should ever be in that situation. As a 36-year-old father of daughters and a person of faith, I look back on that time as a teenager and can say without hesitation that I should have used more wisdom, end quote. That is what he wrote. And I think that this was, when he wrote this, this was after he had already done one interview where it was like, yo, like, why, you know?
Yeah.
Like, yo, why are we talking about this? Like it was one of those. Okay. And then I think the news got to him and he, like, wrote this thing, which was a lot better response for people who were very critical of him.
Right.
And this was, like, months ago. Now, as time has continued on, he's gone back into the press run of doing things. And like I said, the interviews that he does, it's just harder. Like, sometimes it's like,
he's, man, that Hillary Clinton coaching.
Something around it. The other thing I was going to say that came back to me, that now that I'm talking about it, it's escaping me. But no, it had to do around the idea of, like, we were talking about two different things, right? Well, two different arguments, right? The argument that, like, you know, this whole thing is like a setup, right? They're trying to destroy him, whatever. The other argument is just that, like, the profound respect for law that black men sometimes will take on sometimes with regard to this. Like, all of a sudden, we're like, yeah, the court got this right. Meanwhile, we're like, they got it wrong with Zimmerman. They got it wrong with Derrick.
Yeah.
Like, we find all these other times when we're like, yo, man, the court just, they never give us a fair shot. They never give us but this one case, we're like, yo, no, they got it right this time.
Said,
you saw the court said this or whatever. It's like, dude, there's things that we don't, you know, like, just because it can be proven in a court of law doesn't necessarily
now
mean.
Now we with the court.
Now we with the court.
With the court.
And I'm not saying that means for sure he did it. Just more of like,
let's be honest about
how we're portraying this. It's just kind of
And I think there's obviously grace and there's obviously.
Absolutely.
For him, I think he knows the reality of the situation. So let me say up front, I think one, people should see the movie, fully support people, myself, my family, friends. I think it's going to be an amazing film. That's an important film that's done very, very well. I think that if we were to go through history, and not just recent history, but like monumental history, and started to look at art and then look at the man behind the art, and we started to try to find like moral people creating like moral pieces of art that like that were unscathed and untainted, we would lose pretty much every single masterpiece that we'd ever had. I mean, artists are tortured souls generally. People that are able to tap into this very human element that tell very human stories, they do that because they are very generally broken people. Like, the best stories I tell are generally come out of like very hard wounds that like, but I understand the emotions and the real things that therein lie. So like, the ability to tell a story about pain, you have to have suffered very deep tortured pain. So it doesn't surprise me that he would, even if it was like someone else writing in this rape scene, he understands, regardless of if he is innocent or guilty, he understands the pain that would follow being accused of such a thing, or the pain that could potentially it could cause.
Yeah.
And so, man, artists. So again, because of that, I think you have to look at art separately from the artist.
Yeah,
is ultimately the point I'm getting to, is you have to separate it and take it, because, you know,
that's hard.
It is, but
because if you think about, like, I'm just thinking about music. Right. And so, like, if I hear like a rapper, I don't, you know, I can't separate if you didn't live that life and you're rapping about that life.
See, that's a machoism only that exists in hip hop, to be honest.
Maybe
with you.
I'm just saying, but like, I gravitate towards, I like the people that are, you can put them together.
So, and I think for me, I think in every single film, I don't get to get up before I present my films. I don't get to get up and be like, hey, this is me and I'm authentic and I'm real. You need to see that through my art, and you need to sense that through my art. And whether or not the authenticity and the connectivity to the art is true, some of the greatest artists are, and like, they never lived it for a second, but they are true psychologists in the sense that they are able to tap into someone else's experience. One of your songs, Adon, that you talk about a relationship, I think I asked you about it, like, is this your relationship? And you were like, nope. And I'm like, but I was like super connected to your song. And so it's like, I get what you're talking about, David, when it's like, you're just faker. Like, you, but I think that hip hop is this very like people. Yeah, hip hop's different.
It's different. No,
it's different.
I get you. It's different.
Yeah, I think that generally speaking, right, you're, I think that it is something where I completely agree that with artists and the work that they provide as an artist, speaking as one, and then also just as a consumer of art, if I dig into the past of some of these people, it's you know, it's terrible, it's reckless, and I will likely find what I'm looking for, right? If I'm looking for it, I will find it. That being said, I'm going to see this film. I've read a lot about it. I've read a lot of the controversy around it. I will say two things about it, on it. One is that Nat Turner is bigger than Nate Parker.
Yeah.
You understand?
Yes. Like,
the story of Nat Turner.
That's the best point we've made this entire conversation.
Nat Turner is bigger than Nate Parker to me. And so And I take that two different ways, right? Nat Turner is bigger than Nate Parker to me in the sense that I can see beyond Nate Parker's flaws from what I know or what I don't know to then see this film. But then also, this film is not depend. It's bigger than the film. It's Nat Turner is bigger than the film itself to me, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I remember reading, being in my grandfather's office and reading, getting confessions of Nat Turner and, like, reading, like, learning about this guy and, like, being like, whoa, this preacher and this, like, this bloody rebellion and, like, learn all this stuff about it. Like Nat Turner isn't beholden to this medium either or this offering in this work. And so the second part of what I was going to say is that while I'm going to see it, while it sounds like we are all going to see it, people hear about Nate Parker and are like, come to the decision. They're like, nah, I can't do it. I can't. Because there's no way to get around the fact that the money that you're paying for is going to go back to, in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
In some way, shape, or form, it's going to benefit
Nate Parker
in some way, shape, or form. If you're just like, no, I can't do it, I have no judgment against you about that. I think, like, I'm like, man, like, everybody has to make their decisions and their conviction about it. I don't judge people who fall on either side of it. Like, if they are like, man, I'm going to do this, I don't feel like you're supporting rape culture by going to see this film. And then I also don't feel like you are, that you are doing a disservice to black people by not seeing the film.
Yeah, you're right. I just to piggyback, the idea that Nat Turner is bigger than all of this. I remember when I heard that this was going to be a film, I think it's a big piece in hopefully people who understand it. And I hope it's just not just black people that are watching this, but I hope anybody who's not black is watching this, watching from the eyes that this is probably one of the most American things to be done. Mm. You know what I mean? And so I was like, maybe, hopefully it's like reshaping a lot of people's idea of like what a patriot is or what somebody who's fighting like a true freedom fight that we champion here in this country. Like, this is that person, because it's one of the things where we're starting to see it more with more black art coming to the forefront, where we're getting a better understanding of like a bigger and better understanding of what patriotism is or what the things that built this country. And so like certain things, because for me growing up, that story wasn't necessarily it wasn't something that people were the most proud of. It was just kind of like a thing that happened. You didn't see it as something to be like proud of. Mm-hmm. You didn't, as the way you saw like the Minutemen, mm-hmm. like be proud of the Minutemen, how they gathered together to fight, you know, whatever. So it's like one of those things, like as an adult, I'm like, hopefully or later generations can see it in a different light. The same way I talk to people all the time about like the Black Panthers, how like there's this idea of like they were this anti-American. I'm like, no, they're probably the most American thing, the way they were like, here, we don't like the way the government's treating us. We're going to take up arms and do things that we need to do to protect ourselves and the people around us. So, like you said, it's bigger than that. It's bigger than Nate Parker, because I think the idea of just shifting the narrative from a lot of these stories to something that's like, this is American. Mm-hmm. This is an American story. This is very much so American and should be in the same spaces like a lot of these other, you know, things that we've championed for years. So, yeah, I agree with you.
There it is. Ladies and gentlemen, that's our thoughts on Birth of a Nation. Let us know what you think, though. Hit us up on Twitter. Hit us up on 4thdistrict.com. Let us know, are you going to see the film? Do you have an issue with Nate Parker? Do you have an issue with people going to see the film? Do you have an issue with people not going to see the film? Where do you stand at it? Just let us know all those thoughts. Really quick. Just we're going to do Scratch of the Week, but it's just a quick shout out of something that you just want to shout out, person, place, the thing. David Perdue, take it away. You want me to go?
Yeah.
I'll go. My quick shout out has to go to Miss Solange Knowles, okay, who showed up and showed out, put out this record called A Seat at the Table. I've always been someone who feel like I've always liked Solange as like a I don't know how to say it, like, I guess, like, I've always felt like she's been excellent in a lot of different areas, and then like musically I'd feel like she was good to great but not excellent like she's been in other areas, like with regard to her just her style and fashion and visual work and all the stuff like that. I thought these other areas she excelled in, but then I was like, man, just as a musician, while I'm really messed with Soul Angel and Hadley, St. Hadley Street Dreams and stuff like that, I was like, yo, that's dope. But I just always felt like her ideas that she had were great and they didn't necessarily match the output. She put out this record and it's amazing. Like I really can't stop listening to it. And featured some of the work on New Music Monday. But yeah, it's most cohesive body of work. It's amazing. Got these.
I've heard a few tracks.
Yeah.
She did it.
man, do you hear like the star of the album is Master P, basically?
Yes.
Man.
Master P.
Master P shows up. I mean, it's just a really, really crazy, crazy good work. And it's so cohesive, so well put together, so amazing. So, man, I definitely just want to shout out Solange Knowles and Seat at the Table. Definitely check out that record.
All right. I'll have two. One's real quick. I'm very excited to see on Netflix Ava DuVernay's 13th.
Yeah.
I saw the preview for that and I was like, oh, this is gonna be pretty intense.
Right.
And very good. But not to be a company man, but I do wanna shout out Kevin Hart. I definitely wanna shout out and his movie.
Okay.
The What Now?
Yeah.
Only because, like, stadium. As a comedian, you see, no one does. He's setting the bar. Like, I keep commenting on certain things he does, hoping that he sees. Because, like, I don't think maybe he does. I think he definitely does realize that, like, he's setting a standard for the way comedians work and what they can even think is, you know, even possible. Mm-hmm. Just to sell out a football stadium, film it. Like, this is unprecedented.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Someone who's in the in the comedy scene and working and understand like that doesn't make sense.
What's the largest room you've ever done? Do you know that offhand?
Yeah, I think the 40 watt in Athens.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
I did the 40 watt. Well, the largest space I did center stage, but I did center stage last year, but it wasn't filled.
Okay, I got you.
So that was kind of awkward.
I understood.
But doing 40 watt, I think they said it was like 900 people in there.
That's a lot of
or something like that. Yeah, I felt it. I was like, oh, so I'm in show business. But yeah, to understand like just coming from doing bar shows and nothing, you know what I mean? Yeah, and like
where there's
open mics and then see somebody on a stage that, to be perfectly honest, if you were live there, it probably was the worst experience.
I would think.
Comedy is not meant to be in a space like that, traditionally speaking. But to have the audacity to be like, I want to do it in a football stadium and do it in a way never been done. I'm like, yo, like I get, because it's like, I guarantee you it blew his mind because like I know he can remember performing for like four people. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, to do it like that is just like, again, all the editing aside of what he didn't have anything to do with, but all that aside for like what I didn't get on air for his thing, I just think that's just amazing to watch that journey and like see, really understand like the hustle that comes behind it and like all his hard work. So shout out to, like, he needs another one, but shout out to Kevin Hart for just being, you know what I mean, like setting the bar real high.
Yeah. Dan Duncan, take us home.
Yeah, no, I'm going to shout out Fox Searchlight because I never got to this earlier.
Oh, nice, nice.
But we could throw it all the way back to 28 Days Later, Little Miss Sunshine, Slumdog Millionaire, Black Swan,
all the hits.
Hitchcock. Mm. You have 12 Years a Slave, Birdman, The Drop.
So every movie of the year, basically, since
Birth of the Nation. Yeah, Me, Earl, and the Dying Girl.
Oh, I love that movie.
Me too.
I love that. I didn't think I was going to love it, but I love that
movie. It's such a good movie. So, like, literally, their team, they go find just amazing, amazing movies.
That's awesome. Yeah. Fox Searchlight, ladies and gentlemen. If you want to sponsor us, Fox Searchlight, we could use it. But nonetheless, this is Off the Record on behalf of Dan Duncan, the Zika virus carrier, David Perdue, and myself right here. We're going to sign off. Talk to y'all later.
Lights low and the curtains open, and I'm the maestro for this certain moment. Trying to take it sky high, so go alert the stoners. Fear got your guy almost on the verge of blowing it. Bravos, I hear the hand claps.